Campbell, Board Chair. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order on June the 9th, 2021 at 8:30 a.m. We'll do our quick roll call real quick, even though Heather has gone through. Dr. Campbell, present. Dr. Foreman?
Present.
Dr. Ulano?
Present.
Mr. Rhodes?
Present.
Brother Broaddus?
Present.
And Dr. Saunders, our investigator?
I'm present.
And again, we note that Dr. Jared Hall is present here with his attorney, Scott King. Is the complainant TA on the telephone? Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Yadupa and his attorney, Mr. Hall, are present telephonically. Mr. Crawford is here representing Dr. Seth Clark. Is Dr. Clark on the phone? Okay. Well, and then do we have the complainant TF for Dr. Clark's case on the line also? So we're going to go ahead and get started. I will go ahead and read our statement regarding the meetings. Please be advised that this is a professional administrative meeting. All board members will conduct themselves in a professional manner and expected that all other participants will conduct themselves in a professional manner. Combativeness, rudeness, or verbal aggression is not tolerated. And if such behavior occurs, the board chair reserves the right to limit who may address the board. The board strives to conduct its meeting with the utmost respect for the process and for those in attendance. Thank you. Does anyone then have any declaration of conflict of interest to declare for this, any cases in this agenda today? Hearing none, we will move on. So we're going to go ahead and move on to the investigation files under item 5, items for board review, discussion, and possible action. Our first complaint is Dr. Clark. Are you on the phone now, Dr. Clark?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Okay, well, we will start with case 20-17-C, Dr. Seth Clark. Our investigator, of course, is Dr. Saunders. So, and we do have I don't know if the complainant is present on the telephone yet. TF is her. Are the initials. So we also have Mr. Crawford is here representing Dr. Clark. So I'll go ahead and ask Dr. Saunders to please give his report in just a moment. And I just want to preface that with Mr. Crawford. Dr. Saunders, the investigator, was not an investigator on the board when Dr. Clark was going through his previous consent agreement and was not aware of that. So I know there are remarks regarding documentation, but
yeah,
just so that that you all are aware of that. So,
and to clarify, is the complaining party on the phone or not? I didn't hear her.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't
all right.
hear. Yeah.
Thank you.
I believe she told Heather she was going to listen, but apparently she's not there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, Dr. Saunders, if you would proceed with still in the investigation stage, and we needed more information. So this is an updated report from Dr. Saunders. So.
Okay. Yes. Hi. Good morning. So there's a little delay with what I'm hearing from what I'm saying with you guys. So I apologize. I know we had problems last time. I did do a review. I was asked to re-review the case. We got some additional information, I guess, that was provided to me from the board, and there were some concerns regarding medical records, whether they've been altered or not. And yes, I am aware that there were some previous concerns about charting and such like that, so I don't know if this is moot or not, but I did review additional information that was provided to me. Just to kind of summarize again, what I did is I reviewed the billing. Everything appeared to be appropriate for me, and I'm just kind of reading my summary here. I discussed at times that the notes previously were incomplete. They were contradicting at times. I think that was discussed prior. I reiterated that I had some concerns regarding the rationale for the surgical procedures. I guess we can go into that as much as the board wants me to. But of notes that were, I guess, the re-review here was that notes were provided to me from the board, and I compared and contrasted, I guess, which I think maybe were the patient had at one point as well. It's unclear, but there were different notes, and there were some what appeared to be changes or new assertions that were put in there, and I highlighted them for the board. And you know, I received an electronic big PDF file, so the page numbers may not be there, but I did kind of highlight on the board that there were some changes to the records or some additions to the records after the fact. And I kind of noted them, and there was five or six of them, I believe. And I, if the board wants, we can go through each one individually. I think it's up to you guys how you want to proceed with this. I kind of went through. There was a bunch of communications via text message or telephone motions that I put through with the different dates that I highlighted on there. As far as like a summary goes, based on the different notes that were provided to me, but in the basic summary that and I presented to the board, that there were several different changes of additions to the notes that were added that were not prior in your medical record. I don't know if the board wants me to go through each one that they provided for you guys, but it was sort of different. Like non-compliant was added when it wasn't in there before. Different comments there that I put on there.
Right, Dr. Saunders, Dr. Campbell. Yeah, those were a lot of the same things that I had noted when we did the first, you know, the initial part of this investigation. And one of the ones too that you discussed, there was a note on 4/14/17. And then an addendum was written on 6/26/17. So that's, you know, that's to me, that's question one. I know Dr. Clark had gave, you know, his explanation regarding locking and unlocking of notes and every, you know, to and it says right there, it can allow you to edit things. So that's kind of, you know, that draws to me a red flag or kind of makes me a little bit leery, thinking, okay, what's really going on here? Because again, on now our document page numbers are different in our board packets than your pages that you get from Heather. So that's sometimes why it's a little hard to follow, you know, pages you give versus the.
Yeah, I mean, I was able to print them off and compare and contrast. So I can go through. I can go through the different dates, I guess, if the board needs me to point out each one.
Well, I think, for instance, I know this is one of the ones I had that I know you, you know, on 4/26/17, there's a note that says compliant and there's no sign time. Then on the same day, we see now we're compliant. There's an 11:10 a.m. signature stamp. And, you know, that happens, you know, several times. So,
I would agree. I think the contrast that I have seen is that you know, just pointing out that on one chart note, I have both this. I'm just going to pick one here that says on 6/7/2017. I have two copies of different notes. One is from, looks like it's from the Rheumatology Association, and one was from it was printed from a different source. Because one has a logo and one does not, but it says here. At one point it says patient has been compliant with post-op instructions, and then on another page that was a different copy, patient has been non-compliant, has been added in there. And, it, you know, the date and timestamp is actually the same to me. You know, it both says on there 6/7/2017, 1:16 p.m. And there's several different changes there where it says non-compliant was, it seemed to be changed in there. I have it also for the same thing for 6/5/2017, and then a whole big another sentence was added that says that she was patient has been non-compliant with post-operative structures, and then added also was she went to Disney World and walked all over the surgical limb, even without a boot on, had new trauma to the leg, which was outlined in the next office note. So there's several different complete changes like that that are altering the theme of the note that I noticed. I don't have a terrible problem personally with the addendum that was on there. The addendum on 414, or the note, the addendum on 626, I don't actually have a problem with that because at least it's dated and timed and it's noted as an addendum where the other ones are not. Granted, yes, it's 2 months later and you take it for what it's worth, but I personally don't have a problem with that particular addendum note. I have problems with the other ones that look like they were added or changed. And there's several where it's changing the fact of the character of what the note was saying.
I believe Dr. Foreman might have a comment or a question for you.
This be under the consent agreement that we're talking about right now that was already signed, or this would be a separate issue?
Well, this is a separate issue.
Okay.
Yeah, this was something different, totally different.
The changes appear to be all due to post-operative care. Consent was never a concern.
Dr. Sanders, this is Dr. Ilano. So I want to make it clear that he was using two different programs at the time, or just one program at the time the doctor said saw TA.
I can't answer that. I don't know. I have... As the board has, what I've gotten from Heather is that initially I didn't have two different copies of notes, but I do now. And it appears that they're slightly, obviously the notes are altered. Almost all of the progress note is identical except for something that has been changed or altered, and I highlighted that. But some of the notes will have the, Dr. Clark can maybe clarify this, some of the notes that I have in my hand has the stamp Arizona Arthritis Rheumatology Association, and then others do not have that. They are all finalized notes, though. So I am not sure kind of where they're coming from.
One more question. At that time, was he working for the Arizona Rheumatology? When he wrote the note?
I'm under the impression he was, yes.
Okay.
May I? This is Dr. Clark. May I add a little clarification?
No, Dr. Clark. This is Dr. Campbell. We will get to you after Dr. Sanders completes his report and the board asks questions of him. Thank you. Dr. Sanders?
I'm here, Sue. Yep. I don't know if I have more further. I previously, on the initial review, put in some other concerns that I had that I don't think is for discussion at the moment. That's all I have.
So, I know when I looked into Dr. Clark's explanation, he was talking about the availability of locking and unlocking a note so you can go back in and edit and update. So that to me is like, okay, that just kind of sets it up where you can go in and change things. And this is why this, again, to me just doesn't sit well. And I know he talked about the fact that, that he thought the reason was something was initially completed and then the one EMR system, the all scripts, ported the new notes to, or ported the old notes to the new next-gen system, and maybe that's why they're showing possible two versions. But again, why would one version say compliant and the next version say non-compliant? So,
yeah, there's just stark differences, yeah.
Pardon me?
There are stark differences. Plus, things have been added as far as sentences goes as well. So, yes, if it was added or changed, I guess it should have been done more as an addendum immediately after, rather than it should have a different time stamp, I would imagine.
Right, and that could be considered, in some ways that goes back to, documentation, but this is a different issue within documentation of an allegation or a question of alteration of records. So does anybody else have any questions on this topic? part of the complaint investigation?
No.
So, Dr. Saunders, if you want to discuss the MRSA issue.
Okay, let me go back and find this here. So let me get my original note here. I'm trying to find, oh, here it is. Okay. So there was, there's not great documentation on this. I remember when I had, the patient ended up having some MRSA, and it seems to have affected her life greatly afterwards. Apparently the patient, years prior to meeting Dr. Clark, had a surgical procedure. I don't recall, I think it was an elbow, but had a procedure where she developed a MRSA infection. And then what ended up happening at this point is that it's not documented in the chart well, but upon my initial telephone conversation with the patient, it was discussed during the first appointment. I think Dr. Clark acknowledges that, and patient had a significant other also that had brought that up. Patient was admitted right after the surgical procedure as well for some IV antibiotics. But it didn't appear to me at the time that those antibiotics prophylactically were to treat MRSA. It was, you know, in that sense, it wasn't vancomycin or such. It was something else. Patient had been subsequently on several different types of antibiotics during their course of treatment, and one included rifampin, which treated, which sometimes can treat MRSA. As we know now, hindsight, patient is continuing to have problems with some MRSA. I don't know if that's, I don't necessarily associate that to be a problem with Dr. Clark's care. When patient prophylactically maybe had colonization of MRSA, she certainly did not have an active infection of it. And reviewing the previous notes and through care, I don't think that was a problem with Dr. Clark's care.
Yeah, and your comment about that, about the elbow, when last time when I questioned the complainant, I asked, did you ever have MRSA before your surgery with Dr. Clark? And she said no. So we do have a little conflict there of information. So, and again, you know, we all know, we've all done surgery and had patients where some people are carriers. And once you have that nidus, I mean, it can crop up with other procedures. You know, the patient was immunocompromised. The patient's a smoker. You know, those are things that certainly would lend towards, you know, postoperative complications. So I do agree with you. I don't think that that's really anything to do with Dr. Clark's care. And again, too, Dr. Mark Campbell, who did the surgery in July of, I think it was the 17th of July, 17, anyway, or 7th maybe, noted on the op report that the area was clean, and he only felt that the anchor was colonized. And the final CNS on it said light growth of MRSA. So we know that the patient had been on lots of other antibiotics, had been through antibiotic courses. So... I think it's just one of those. And I'm sure on Dr. Clark's consent for the surgery, it was noted that that's a possible complication of surgery is post-op infection. So, you know, I do agree with you on your evaluation of that. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Uano, do you have any questions regarding that or comments?
Well, most of it was the documentation that I had a problem with, which we've already...
Dr. Ilano, did you have any questions on that for?
No, Dr. Ilano has no.
Okay.
No questions for that at this time.
So it looks like do you have anything to add, Dr. Saunders, before we talk to Dr. Clark and Mr. Proffer?
Nothing new that I haven't mentioned previously. No, I'm fine.
Okay. Dr. Clark, would you like to make, or Bruce, Mr. Crawford will go first.
No, okay. Yeah, I just thought I would make a few comments at the beginning, and if I'm redundant, I apologize. I don't know what your all of your concerns may be. I went back and looked at the complaint from this patient and what she was claiming. First, she claimed that she didn't know what the surgeries were going to entail before surgery. The preoperative records, the consent, the scheduling records all are very clear as to what was going to be done. And that's both true, the one at Dr. Clark's office, but also the one at the surgery center. What's also interesting is that when she goes to New York, and what my understanding of what happened is she went to New York, and while there, the wound had been doing well, but then it opened up again, and Dr. Clark recommended that she go get it checked because she's in a different state. He can't bring her into the office, and so the easiest thing is to have her go to the ED. She does, and then she gives a history to them that the wound had actually been doing well until, quote-unquote, 8 days ago. So the ED physician called Dr. Clark, talked with him, and they basically came to an agreement that continue on the, I think it was doxycycline, if I recall correctly. There clearly wasn't any evidence of a systemic infection going on at that point. So this comment that this remained infected for 2 months is just not accurate. In terms of Dr. Campbell, I think she said that the screw broke, and that was the site of the MRSA infection, which is clearly not accurate. And I've looked at those records, the very voluminous records, and honestly, I believe they do confirm her noncompliance with multiple issues. So, not the least of which, one, walking on the foot, but then, I'm sorry, going to New York, and then also, she was a heavy smoker during this whole time. So, again, I apologize if I'm going into issues that maybe you don't have as much concern about, but I don't know. So then, in terms of the records, we previously, in 2017, there was a significant problem related to the EMR system. That's already been gone through with the board, different problems with it. And then Dr. Clark agreed to a consent agreement, so he was monitored, and the board was satisfied at the end of that he had improved. So this case relates to 2017, so it's kind of the same issue. In terms of the EMR issue, I'll just tell you that AARA had a EMR system called Allscripts. You can call it antiquated. You can call it not helpful for podiatry care, whatever you want to call it. And then what happened in April of 2018, they switched. And this old system, whatever records were there or weren't there, who knows, somehow it was supposed to be ported over to the new next-gen system. And honestly, trying to track the records and follow all of this over the couple years now I've been with Dr. Clark has been extremely difficult because of that. And AARA has acknowledged that there were significant problems related to this whole transition. So Dr. Clark can tell you what he did when he got the request in for records and what he provided to the board. And beyond that, it's pretty tough for him to go into it in any more detail. He doesn't work for AARA. He has started his own office. For a while, he had the read-only type of ability to correct records. I think in this case, he couldn't even download the entire chart. He had to just, when he got the request for records, he had to try and actually print out separate notes. So he can go into those issues, but from my perspective, this is all more problems with the EMR systems that he doesn't have any control over, and he's limited on what he can tell you about it.
That's one of the things that I would like to hear Dr. Clark's explanation, because sometimes when you read it, that's not always the same as hearing it exactly from somebody as to what happened. Sure. So, Dr. Clark, please let us know what your thoughts are.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate all the thought and clarification there on a few topics. So, I'll just dive into the records issue, because the care issue has been addressed, and I believe I agree with all of you that the care was appropriate for her. The main thing that, to kind of reiterate what Bruce said, is so this system where the notes supposedly come from was called Allscripts. It was used by AARA up until, I believe it was the end of March or end of May or April, somewhere right around there of 2018. At that time, when they switched over to their newer system that they now use, as of, April 2018, there I had no login to that system. There was no way to mess with anything in that system anymore. I think part of the issue is, and AARA has acknowledged multiple times, that as notes recorded from their old system, they are a huge rheumatology group. They have like 26 providers across the entire state. And when porting things over from their old system, things didn't port correctly. There were various mistakes that were made, which they've acknowledged multiple times. And so when records were produced to the board, they were coming from the patient, from Allscripts, from the new next-gen system that had ported things over. And again, with all, the IT department at AARA has kind of told me multiple times too that they just can't figure out how, and it wasn't just, with my patients. They have current patients that they've told me that, we have a lot of record issues that they're still trying to sort through. And so, I think the biggest thing going forward is we know that, for the better and worse in a lot of different ways, but for the better, I've been able to start my own practice, have a more podiatry appropriate electronic record system going forward that reduces these types of errors that happen. I've provided somewhat of an explanation of how I think it could have happened, but this was 4 years ago now, and without a login to that system for over 3 years since April of 2018, I really don't remember exactly how everything went down. I just know that from time to time, and I'm sure you members of the board as well, when you see patients, they're maybe addendums that get made and small changes that need to be made here and there after the initial encounter. And so, again, it's two record systems ago for me. The porting and importing and exporting and all of that has been an absolute nightmare from everyone's perspective. And so I provided a little bit of an explanation. Bruce has kind of provided it as well. And I think I agree with Bruce that while this case wasn't necessarily included in the consent agreement, the overall issue with medical records from that Allscripts system pre, April 2018, has definitely been addressed. And I can verify going forward that these issues can't happen anymore, because that system is long gone, 3 years, at least 3 years past now. So that's kind of my thought process on it, and I appreciate the input from everyone on it.
So, Dr. Clark, what system are you using now?
So I now use, in my practice, that we use a next-gen system as well. It's not the same one that AARA currently uses. It's next-gen office. It used to be called MediTouch.
So it's been working okay for you?
It's great. I had purchased David Jaffe's practice out in Sun City West, and he had been using it for years and loved it to pieces. And so when I purchased his practice and kind of merged it with what I was starting on my own, we just kept his record system, and it's been great. The flow is better. It's easier to be coherent in how everything works. So, yes, this was a system that actually was designed specifically for podiatry, and it has been a huge breath of fresh air. I have next month I'll have my fifth doctor who works for me as well, and all of us, this consensus agreed that between the dozens of EMRs you've used over the years, this is by far the best the most podiatry-friendly, the best for surgeons, the best for reducing errors. So, yes, I'm very, very happy with my current system.
So does it have, like, a Dragon component, or you're just typing in?
It's a lot more free text, and because it's web-based, you can, you know, use Dragon dictation very easily and things like that. But there's a lot more text boxes rather than little click boxes. That was kind of the issue with this Allscripts old system, is everything was all click here, click there, and if you click wrong in the wrong place, you can't undo it. And so, yes, the newer system, it's very free text, very, you know, Dragon dictation capable, and that's, we have a subscription to Dragon that we use, and it's really been very beneficial.
Dr. Foreman, you have any questions for Dr. Clark?
So when the charts were ported over from the Allscripts over to the next gen, did you just updated what you thought was in there that didn't port over? Is that what happened?
No, I didn't update anything. Everything ported over automatically, and obviously that was, you know, in April or so of 2018, which would have been, you know, a little over 2 years before this board complaint even came about. And so, no. So the only access I had last August when the board complaint hit was I still had a login to their new next-gen system that they use. And so there was an export feature where I could just click on the patient and export all of their notes, which is what I did. But apparently me exporting those notes and them, because they obviously still have a login to Allscripts because they have to for 7 years. And so they exported from Allscripts. I exported from NextGen. I'm not sure where the patient got her records from. I think so I don't know exactly how it all went down on the patient end of things. And that's why the notes, they look so different in a lot of ways. Some of them have logos, some have signatures. There's just this jumble of trying to get from the two different systems and things getting imported and exported that there was just, So after, you know, after 2018, when I switched to the new system with AARA, I hadn't even heard from the patient because she had moved to New York. And so I hadn't heard from her or seen her again or anything I hadn't even opened her chart until last August, when this complaint came about.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Ilano?
You're welcome.
Dr. Ilano?
Yeah, I'm here. I got a question. Do you know how those added sentences got into the two different charts, or the discrepancy?
So that's a good question, and it's been about 4 years, four and a half, so I really don't know to say exactly. I just know that with those two systems that I used with AARA, there were methods where if you noticed that there was something wrong, you could, you know, either make the addendums, unlock, change things. And so, again, none of that could have been done after 2018 when Allscripts ceased to be used. But it's long enough ago. I know that, you know, it's frequent that I'll do a surgery, I'll see a post-op appointment, and then they call me later that day with some issue that I have to then go in and you know, make addendums and do things. So I unfortunately don't know the exact circumstances, just given the time that it was ago.
Mr. Rhodes, do you have a question?
Pretty much as everything's been answered, I would just say documentation and better notes, and that's been updated apparently. Patient, I think if they're not compliant, they contributed to this problem.
I think we've probably discussed this pretty thoroughly, and that we're all in agreement here that the care was no issue, or talking about MRSA and noncompliance and, you know, in that direction of care was not the issue. And I think, you know, other than having a forensic audit on charts, it's just kind of, you know, I think it's a good lesson for us to remember to really watch our EMR systems, pay attention, do quarterly audits on your charts so you make sure everything's up to snuff and working. So, and obviously, you know, it sounds like Dr. Clark's been, you know, is happier with this system. And obviously, you know, we've been through the documentation issue in the past and had improved from that. So you know, I think this is kind of something that's really difficult to go into any further. And so I was going to go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 20-17-C, finding no violation of state statute.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see everybody without masks, by the way.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Saunders. We're going to move on to our next complaint, which is 21-01-C. Is Dr. Jared Hall. Of course, Dr. Saunders is our investigator on that case. We have Dr. Hall is present this morning with counsel Scott King. The complainant on the phone, Heather? TA? Are we there? Okay. So, we'll start with Dr. Saunders' complaint, and then we'll ask the, or his review, and then ask the complainant if for a 5-minute summary. And then we will hear from Dr. Hall and his counsel. So, Dr. Saunders, please.
Okay, it's been a little while since I've looked at this again, but initial complaint here is by a TA patient regarding just negligence in the postoperative care, surgery performed by Dr. Hall. I did speak with the complainant at a telephone interview, and the patient is not blaming Dr. Hall for the infection, but felt resolving the infection or getting rid of it, there was some, that was her negligence concerned. Patient felt that Dr. Hall was ignoring concerns that she had had, communicating, again, MRSA infection as well. There was a bunch of texting going back and forth with some pictures and communication to Dr. Hall and staff, shall we say. At one point, she felt like the staff and Dr. Hall were just ignoring her. She comments that one response was that there's nothing we can do. You can come back in and get another ACE wrap. Didn't feel like that they were listening to her. There's a written response by Dr. Hall regarding all, and then my medical review as well. But Dr. Hall was made aware of the MRSA infection that the patient had previously on a first appointment. Surgical procedures were performed. Dr. Hall did some procedures to take the varus load off of the patient's fifth ray. That's what she presented with some concerns. Going into the procedures and such and choice, Dr. Hall had initially planned on doing one procedure preoperatively and then intraoperatively changed procedures, and we went into that a little bit with the review here. But focusing on some of the concerns regarding post-op care, they did go back and forth. Dr. Hall does acknowledge that there was some texting and communication, and we all know that sometimes things get lost in translation there. Dr. Hall provided also a written response where he goes into some of his preoperative planning and postoperative care that he has per his protocols. He decided that, or describes on the post-op visit that he reviewed management, prescribed some iodazorb for the patient for the wound. There was some slight dehiscence or redness that was noted. There was an ongoing communication back and forth with the patient and the staff, whereas if the redness resolves with elevation, there's no problems. And this was a kind of a recurrent theme as we go through the report. There was a going back and forth. The patient will communicate, well, if the redness resolves when you elevate your foot, then there's nothing to be concerned about. And this was also communicated in some text messaging as well. After a couple of weeks postoperatively, it then gets documented that the patient did have a fever, and a prescription called Vivox was prescribed. Labs and a little bit of a workup for the wound and possible infection was then doing that. Postoperatively, Dr. Hall also describes that there was some visits to the ER during this time. Just reviewing some of the medical records that I went through is that on the very first appointment, patient was having on and off pain just for approximately just 2 months. Patient did have an extensive history of a previous gunshot wound and had some hind foot arthrodesis done prior to Dr. Hall getting involved with this patient. There was no mention necessary in Dr. Hall's notes for MRSA infection as well. Initial representatives, documentation is only just for the right foot. There is no documentation of an evaluation of the other foot. I discussed with Dr. Hall. He says, you know, he normally does a full body, shall we say, evaluation. It just was not necessarily documented. The left foot was showing some signs and pain to the fifth metatarsal base, and goes into it. It's documented that there is conservative and surgical options that were discussed for the patient, but at this time surgery was scheduled on the first visit. And consents were signed the day of the surgery, again, for some preoperative planning. They were going to do a med cuneiform arthrodesis with a cotton and a calcaneal osteotomy, gastroc recession. In review of the chart, there's some documentation issues. The op note did not necessarily document any removal of hardware, which was obviously performed when comparing it as part of the procedures. The surgical operative report is describing a plantar fracture first metatarsal osteotomy with a graft and fixation, endoscopic gastric recession. It was documented that a cotton procedure was done, but in essence, in clinical review and even discussing with Dr. Hall, it was not done. So postoperatively, the patient was admitted, I think, for one night. Just for pain control. Patient did follow back a few days later, went back to the ER, and the ER notes did not demonstrate any signs of infection at that time or any kind of complication. It was just there for pain control. ER documentation did not have any concerns. Follow-up exams, it then gets reported that patient previously had infection, staph infection. Patient was treated for some iodosorb, had a little bit of a wound, but not clinically infected per the notes. Patient came back a couple days later feeling that the incisions are infected, was real concerned about this, and there was some text messaging in between. Patient's further upset because she wasn't brought back into the office based on her text messaging and such like that. But she was concerned of an infection. Dr. Hall relates that there's just some fibrosis at the wound or some mild erythema. X-rays were taken without any type of process. I think it was the third visit at that point that labs were ordered and a prescription for Zyvox was prescribed for the patient to take, and then they discussed the ongoing wound care. Patient subsequently again went to the ER. This is the second or third time. Wound cultures were then taken at that point, which later came back as MRSA, and subsequently care, patient was started on IV antibiotics, it was Vanco. During this time period at the second one, when the doctor, when the patient went back to the ER, Dr. Hall was out of town and had a covering orthopedic see them. Covering doctor did not feel that this was a significant wound complication, did not feel like surgery was necessary at this point. Dr. Hall, upon his revival, subsequently did follow back up when he got back into town and agreed just with IV antibiotics for the recovery period at that point. I went through some of the ER notes. Again, no real signs of a abscess formation. It did have a slight cellulitis for which they were treating for MRSA. Patient did have a very mild WBC elevation, which normalized during the hospitalization. Normal ESR levels were seen. We had some problems with billing, and I discussed this with Dr. Hall as he was going through a transition that he can probably explain better. But apparently, he did not have any billing for this patient at all, so there was nothing really to review. The hospital did bill for the CPT codes. Dr. Hall was actually employed by the hospital at the time, so the hospital did bill for the codes. However, they billed for the wrong codes. One of the issues that I had noticed is that as Dr. Hall changed procedures, he did not change the initial billing that was on the record. I discussed with him that there were some problems noted where he didn't change what he had planned to do and review it or discuss with the billing that how I didn't do what I was planning to do. And he can alliterate to that a little bit. So I'm not sure if the hospital billed the most appropriate procedures as they were slightly changed during it. In discussing with Dr. Hall regarding this, he goes, his normal cases, he usually, if he does change the procedure intraoperative based on findings, that he would make the subsequent changes to whoever is doing the billing for him. And we acknowledged that the dictation of the operative report was not necessarily the best. We discussed a little bit of documentation as well as some of the text messages need to be part of the medical record if you're going to go that route with care. Post-operatively, the big concern of the patients was whether her care was appropriate or not. I went through the records at the very first sign and symptom really of a problem. Clinically, Dr. Hall did prescribe an appropriate antibiotic. He was treating the wound appropriately with his choice of iodoform. I think that was appropriate. There was some discussion of wound care if the patient did not heal at that point. It's real difficult to determine when the actual cellulitis did start. I have seen some of the pictures that were sent, and according to some of the pictures, even though it's a camera and it's a text message, there was no gross signs of a streaking or a lymphangitis or abscess formation. They looked fairly benign and normal. According to fever and signs of sepsis or systemic illness, even in one of the visits to the ER, a patient was normalized when she went for pain. When the patient went, I think it's the third time, it was just that the documentation says that the fever was just a new onset and it wasn't ongoing. A fever for 3 or 4 weeks at that point. So I don't think that there's any problem with the postoperative care and the wound management. I discussed with Dr. Hall the texting and the back and forth is a difficult way for documentation. I'm pretty sure he agrees with that. We discussed that there were some documentation issues with progress notes, not documenting contralateral limb evaluations, the operative report, the change in procedure. Though doctor did get a consent for one thing and did a slightly different procedure, I don't think that changes the rationale or the consent agreement with the patient. I don't think that's a violation if the goals for accomplishing the procedures were the same. And that was a little haphazard, I apologize, but I can help clear that up if there's any questions.
Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Not for Dr. Saunders.
Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions for Dr. Saunders.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Saunders. Okay. Now we have our complainant, TA, is present on the line. And we can go ahead and have try to summarize your remarks. About 5 minutes, please, and then we can ask questions.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to quickly read a letter that I wrote that pretty much explains it and clarifies a couple mishaps with the investigation. I had only seen Dr. Hall twice, first appointment and the final appointment where I was admitted. But we informed Mr. Hall of my past history of MRSA at the first appointment prior to surgery, both myself and my partner. I had a long healing infection on my elbow with MRSA, and I don't believe any additional protocols were made prior to my surgery for this. In addition, he planted hardware and bone grafts, yet he still did not order antibiotics for after surgery to take home. At the first week appointment, we adamantly voiced our concern of infection. Starting, my foot was red at the top of the incision and splitting. We had gone through this for 10 months with my elbow, so very clear. He had me raise my foot over my head and explained if the blood ran out, there was no infection. Another opportunity to prescribe an antibiotic, which he chose not to. During week two, I sent on two different occasions texts and pictures of increasing redness and swelling, as well as voicing my concern of the infection getting worse. Mr. Hall himself never responded. His nurse called the first time, and I was told the same thing. Raise my foot over my head to check if the redness disappeared, then continue to elevate and compression wrap. I explained how painful the compression wrap was, but to no avail. The second message was ignored until I called in. This time I was told there was nothing they could do unless I wanted to come get another ACE bandage. I was confused but was told further compression wrap it. Clearly they were not listening to what I had to say. A fourth time he could have ordered antibiotic or at very least bring me in to put eyes on it, and he chose not to. At my 4-week follow-up, it was clearly infected, green oozing out of the incision. After following all their instructions, Mr. Hall now blames me for the infection that for 3 weeks he refused to acknowledge and claimed I did not have. At this point, he had multiple opportunities to do something yet chose not to. The night of my 4-week follow-up, I ended up in the ER after his visit. And the following day, I was admitted, which turned into 7 months of hospital stay and 9 surgeries. The infection was the cause of my amputation. Make matters worse, when Mr. Hall came back from vacation and came into my room in the hospital, his only concern was to cancel my care. He had no intentions of trying to help. He asked me 3 times if I wanted to have him release my care. In tears on the 3rd time, I had no choice but to say yes. This was one of the scariest times of my life. I had no idea what was about to come, but I knew it wasn't good. I had a raging infection and no doctor. My life is forever changed because of his actions and his choices. He chose not to look, he chose not to listen, and he chose to ignore my concerns completely. He did not follow his oath to do no harm. He will never know or care, I believe, how much harm he has caused. Emotionally, financially, physically, this will follow me the rest of my life and my family. I will never be who I was or do the things I was able to do. It's a daily struggle, and the pain is relentless. It will only get worse as I get older. I believe he needs to be held accountable for his actions, or in this case, lack thereof. I do want to add one other thing. When I went to the ER, Dr. Saunders mentioned that the on-call doc did not say anything. He actually told us that evening that it was very likely that the hardware was going to have to be removed. And if I have a little bit more time, I would really like to have my other half speak, because she went through this entire situation with me. Is that possible?
You know, I think your summary is good enough. Thank you. Your summary is perfect. Because we're going to ask you questions too, which will be, you know, additional. So you can you repeat that, ma'am, that you said about the orthopedic surgeon said that the hardware should be removed?
Yes. I had 2 different ones because it was during the holidays. There was one from out of town, I believe Denver, and they straight up told us, because we both looked at each other in awe, that the hardware would have to be removed because once MRSA is attached to it, it is not able to be cured. One other thing, the Zyvox was not ordered until that 4-week appointment right before I ended up in the hospital.
All right. So if that is, if do you have any additional comments before we?
Yes, one more thing. On that 4-week follow-up, when he told me it was my fault for the infection, he mentioned I had gotten it wet prior to when I was released. That's clearly not true. I have pictures showing it intact. But after he left and his nurse wrapped my foot, she put gloves on, went through all the drawers, went out in the hall, came back in, touched everything. We complained to the office manager, and yet there's no notes or any issues of, you know. So, yes.
So you said there were no gloves worn?
No, she wore gloves, but she went through all the drawers, touched everything, went outside. I don't know what she did, and when she came back in, she had the same gloves on, and then touched my padding that she then wrapped my foot with. And, you know, that's when they know I have an infection. I mean, there was green coming out of it. And there's no record of our complaint, office.
This is Dr. Saunders again. Dr. Hall did address the care of that with his staff, and I'm pretty sure that staffer is no longer employed by Dr. Hall, but he did address that afterwards, as he discussed with me, as far as appropriate, I will say, prevention of biohazards.
Any files or any documentation, and we pretty much pulled all of them.
All right. Well, ma'am, if I've got some questions I'd like to ask you, and you just had mentioned this, so my just wanted to verify that any time post-operatively that you got, did you get your incision wet?
No, not until I was released after the first appointment from the nurse.
Okay.
Blythe, I believe her name, and she gave, we were over careful with everything because of my past history.
Okay. Okay, so, and were you clear on all your post-operative instructions that you were given? And were your
yep.
questions appropriately answered?
Well, after the first appointment, when we told them that we were concerned of infection because we've been through this so much, all they did was give a topical ointment to put on it. And then the next two, I didn't have another appointment until the 4-week follow-up, so when I sent texts and pictures, I was completely ignored.
So can you tell, ma'am, do you have a history yourself of diabetes, or is it just a family history?
There's nobody in my family with diabetes. I've never had diabetes, and I do not have diabetes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. And you said you did tell Dr. Hall in the first visit that you had the past history of MRSA from the elbow surgery, correct?
Absolutely. And he was aware that I had battled it for 10 months.
Was there any offer of conservative care to you, or it just went straight to surgery?
Straight to surgery. He mentioned, interestingly enough, he mentioned orthotics, but then explained that eventually I'm going to wear through the bottom of my foot. And the first thing we were told out of surgery, Sarah was there with me, was that I'm probably still going to need orthotics.
So prior to the surgery, were you seen by your primary care doctor to be examined and get medical release for surgery?
I was referred to Dr. Hall from my primary care, but then everything went through him after that.
So your primary care did not do an examination of you before the surgery. Didn't listen to your heart, your lungs, look in your eyes.
Well, I believe so. That's pretty typical when I go in to see them, but it wasn't an overall exam for my foot or leg or anything.
Okay, so but what I'm asking was, before to give the okay for you to have surgery, you were not examined by your primary care doctor for strictly for that purpose?
No, because they were not aware that I was going to be having surgery at that point. I was just getting a referral over to Dr. Hall.
Okay.
He ordered the chest x-ray or I think it was a EKG, and he did an x-ray in his office of my foot.
Okay, so did Dr. Hall listen to your heart or your lungs? And
nope.
No. So when you were at the hospital, did the anesthesiologist do any kind of general physical exam on you?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't believe so. Dr. Hall just examined my foot, and I don't recall. I'm sorry, with the anesthesiologist.
Okay. Thank you for answering my questions. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for the complainant?
Yes, when you went to the emergency room, did they give you any antibiotics at the emergency room for the four-week visit?
No, when I went to the ER, it was prior to my first appointment with Dr. Hall, and it was strictly for pain. The block had worn off, and I was told if that's what I need to do that. So that's what we did.
Thank you.
Dr. Ilano, sir, do you have questions?
Sure. Anytime, let's say when you went to the ER the 4 days after for pain control, did you have any fevers, chills?
No, sir, but I will add, through 9 surgeries, I only had a fever one time, and that's when I caught the flu in the hospital. I am atypical when it comes to that.
Okay. Now, did you, let's say after the second one, 1 month post-op, and you went back to the office of Dr. Hall and subsequently to the ER, did you have any fevers or any complaints of that? Chills?
I only saw Dr. Hall 2 times. The first week appointment, which we explained our concerns, and then at the 4 week appointment, I had sent texts and asked Blythe to come in, but I was not given an appointment. I was told if the blood ran out when I lifted my head, then I was good to go.
Okay. Was on the, let's say on the 4 week exam, was the wound opened up, or was it just sort of dried blood around the area?
Oh no, it was completely open. There was green oozing out, and he immediately said there was an infection and that I'd have to go to wound care, I'd have to get blood work, I'd have to do a couple other things, but then he left on vacation, so we really didn't know what we were supposed to do at that point anyway. And that's when the Zyvox was ordered, not until then.
Oh. Okay, he ordered the wound care at that point. And how soon did you get the wound care after that?
No, he didn't order it, he suggested it, and he gave us a script for blood work, but again, then he left on vacation. So we sat out in the waiting room for quite some time trying to figure out what exactly we were supposed to do. And wound care was never set up. It just was told that I would have to go there.
And then when you went to, that's when you were taking care of the, in the ER a couple of days afterwards?
That evening.
For your infection.
Because
that evening.
Blythe then wrapped it after that appointment. He left, she wrapped it. The compression was so tight that the pain was, I couldn't handle it. So we ended up at the ER that evening. I was told by Dr. Hall, actually, when I left, that to leave it compression wrapped for 5 days. I was also told in the ER, if that would have been the case, I would have lost my foot. And unfortunately, at that point, we didn't know that was going to be the case. But, yeah, there was some discrepancies for sure.
Ma'am, this is Dr. Okay. Campbell again. Can you, what type of amputation did you end up with, ma'am?
I had a below knee. They took the hardware out. I had four surgeries on the foot to try to get the infection. They removed the hardware, then they removed the bone grafts, and then it ended up getting necrotizing fasciitis, and they had to pretty much take most of my foot, and then they brought in the orthopedist about doing an amputation because they couldn't get the infection under control. And I might add just one other thing. I have had a surgery since the foot surgery. I had a back surgery, and their protocol, knowing that I had MRSA, was entirely different. And I had no problems with that surgery.
That's good. We appreciate your time in speaking with us and allowing us to discuss and ask questions of you. Thank you very much. So now we will proceed on to hear now from Dr. Hall. I don't know if Dr. Hall wants to begin or if Mr. King has a statement to make first.
I'd just like to make a brief statement, if I may. Regarding this patient, the surgery occurred on November 21st, 2019, and Dr. Hall kept the patient in the hospital overnight and give her an additional IV antibiotic as well as morphine for pain control. It is important to note that the patient that the infection was there from the start of the surgery. But when she was seen in the ER on November 24th, so it's 3 days post-operative, there was, and Dr. Saunders confirmed this as well, there was no indication that the patient had an infection at that time. Dr. Hall saw the patient on December 2nd. For her antibiotic ointment to be applied to the surgical line, and then saw her again on December 20th and prescribed Zyvox, which I understand would be effective with MRSA. One thing that Dr. Hall was concerned about is the patient had a pretty on antibiotics, and he was keeping that in mind while he was taking care of her. It's also in his December 20 note, Dr. Hall documented that the patient stopped the iodosor because it made the incisions too late, and she stopped using the depressive dressing. Dr. Hall tried to accommodate the patient with a tubic grip, an ACE wrap, and commercial compression socks, but the patient did not wear those. On December 20th, Dr. Hall performed x-rays, ordered a CBC with death, a BNP, ESR, and CRP. And again, he also prescribed the physical box for the patient. The following day, and a normal white count, 10,700, and there was no bandemia, and her vital signs were also normal. Dr. Hall saw the patient in the hospital on December 24th, and it was the patient's decision, not Dr. Hall's, to dismiss the patient, or fire Dr. Hall. Dr. Hall didn't dismiss the patient. and was quite willing to care for her patient fired him on December 4th. There was, when we produced all the medical records that we had in our possession, and there was no indication that Dr. Hall's operative care was substandard at Dr. Saunders. And regarding the billing, we provided a statement from Gene Collins, who was the office manager, and there was a change in the office practice. The biller that they were using left, and Summit Healthcare took over the billing responsibilities. And there was also a new electronic health record done at that time. Summit, at our request, tried diligently to find the bills, but they just said it was an impossibility. Again, that was not on Dr. Paul, as Summit had assumed that role. Lastly, I would like to say that we're asking the board to dismiss this. Dr. Hall, there's a little bit of a confusion about the operative report. There was a change intraoperatively in a procedure, but as Dr. Saunders noted, Dr. Hall did document that procedure that he did perform, and that's in the operative report. He inadvertently left in the cotton procedure, which he did not perform, but did put in the operative report the procedure he did. Thank you very much.
And Dr. Hall, please.
Madam President, members of the board, thank you for this opportunity to address you today. I do express genuine sadness at the struggle and ultimate outcome that TA has experienced. I agree with Dr. Saunders' conclusion that I provided appropriate postoperative care to patient TA after her November 21st, 2019 surgery. I discussed wound care with the patient preoperatively and postoperatively when I saw her in the office on December 2nd and again on December 20th, 2019. My postoperative treatment of TA included, among other things, prescribing iodazorb for the patient's surgical incision, ordering postoperative x-rays, labs, applying compression dressing, and prescribing Zyvox when her surgical incision had some fibrosis at the base with ecchymosis. I respectfully submit that my treatment of TA met the standard of care, and I ask the board to dismiss the case. I am available to answer any questions by the board members.
Okay, so I will go ahead and start because I always have questions. Did you do a general exam on the patient for pre-op?
Yes, I did.
So is it the protocol of the hospital there that the podiatrist can be seen as the admitting physician so that there is, you know, so is it precluded that you have a primary physician do a pre-op H&P? And or is it, does the anesthesiologist perform a pre-op H&P that morning?
Thank you. Hopefully I can answer this accurately. If not, please stop me. In my note on the pre-op visit, I do document a general exam, an extensive head-to-toe exam, including listening to heart and lungs. It is my practice to do that. I do have full privileges at the hospital. So I do my own pre-op H&Ps. Our protocol is when there are indications, we will get other clearances. For example, pulmonology, cardiology, and general medical clearances are the most common that we do get. In this case, I did not see anything that warranted getting an additional medical clearance. We do, as a standard, let the primary care provider know by sending the notes to them, which I work closely with in the small community. I'm familiar with each of them. That the surgery is happening, so they were aware of that. In addition, anesthesia the anesthesia provider reviews the chart ahead of time. It's usually about 3 to 14 days prior to the surgery, and they will recommend, or quite frankly, case, if there are additional clearances needed, is our protocol. They do also examine the patient listening to the heart and lungs, as does the pre-op nurse.
And they're the ones in that do the anesthesia consent.
Anesthesia does do their own consent.
So for you to maintain that full privilege, what kind of documentation do you have to show to them of your ability to perform a full body HMP?
I provide documentation on each of my pre-op HMPs. In this medical record, which it has changed since then, it is listed. This is from October 22nd, 2019, that I'm referring to. I do a complete review of systems. There's a medical history, surgical history, family history, medications, allergies, and then an extended exam. And this note, the extended exam, is listed under the heading general. And then I also do a focused exam.
Oh, but what I'm saying is you have to, have documentation that proves that you have appropriate training to perform.
I hope I meant during my residency training, as part of my credentialing process, I did have to provide documentation with H&Ps and the ability. That is something that was done when I started at the hospital. I hope I'm answering that question.
Yeah, that's why I was curious. That's why I wanted to ask you the protocol questions. How they? And I know because you are in more of a rural setting as compared to metropolis. So when you're talking about it, so a question I do have too is, I'm kind of concerned about, I know you said you focus in on the lower extremity that's involved, but to me a good physical exam includes comparison of the other extremities. So that's something that kind of, it's like, okay, why aren't we, the patient obviously has a left and a right here, and why you did not document any examination of the left?
The left extremity was briefly examined. It is noted in the note that it was not because the exam was brief. It was more of a survey. In this case, because of the unique nature of her injuries and the subsequent surgeries that occurred, this limb was quite different from the contralateral limb, as opposed to a more systemic posterior tibial tendon dysfunction or other comparison. I did not feel that it offered as much benefit. That was the reasoning behind it. Certainly, I can admit that there's benefit in evaluating both sides.
So there was, I believe you had indicated to Dr. Saunders that there was a date you saw the patient preoperatively that was not charted. What day was that?
The specific date I do not have. The circumstances around that were, on the initial visit, when I visited with TA, she was alone, and her significant other was very interested in knowing about this, as well as options, conservative options, and the rationale for proceeding with surgery. There was a second visit that was, for lack of a better term, accommodated during the middle of a practice day, and there was no treatment rendered, no examination performed. It was a purely discussion with TA and the person that she asked to come with her. So it was in hindsight, I would document that, but there was no treatment offered, there was no examination. It was purely additional clarification into the risks, benefits, alternatives, and indications for this particular case. which was a repeat of what was documented in the initial history and physical.
So no additional documents were signed?
There was no additional documentation for that informational visit.
May I say something?
Ma'am, I'm sorry. You've had your time. I'm sorry. This is doctor's time. You've had your time to speak and questions answered and between us and the board. So this is the doctor's time. Thank you. So do you on your system? Do you type in yours, or you said something about a transcribing ear? Do you use a scribe, or what's your protocol in your office?
Yes, I do have MA scribes. I have found it to, there's a training and a learning curve that is involved with this. The scribe on this was new, but we do a scribe where they're in the room and they're literally typing as we talk. In general, as a practice, we find that to be accurate where there are two witnesses essentially putting information into the chart, and I do use a scribe. That also is a medical
assistant. So do you review their notes, they review that before you sign those notes?
I do.
And you said they are trained in podiatry procedures and nomenclature so that they're aware of what there's
right? There is a training, yes, and I do provide that training.
So this is a subject that I do you think that, I know, and it's part of a medical record because it's out there now with all this electronics, that text messages are really an appropriate way to evaluate a patient? I'm old-fashioned, I'm hands-on, hands and eyes, and I just want to, that to me, that's something that concerns me, is particularly when you have a patient with the history that this patient had, you know, the medical issues, previous surgeries, et cetera, that I personally find that a hard thing to hang your hat on.
Certainly. No, I do not feel that text messages have the same, is an equivocal value as an in-person evaluation. Having said that, I am the only podiatrist in my practice. As an option to help those patients that are higher risk, which is a large percentage of my practice. I do offer them my cell phone to get a hold of me in the event that they can't get a hold of someone else. There is a call center. There are other things, but in some cases that's cumbersome in the slow where I practice. Just as an extension of kindness, I've offered that. We have made some changes since this has taken place. And those changes include, in the new EMR, we have a phone note that's been built. When text messages occur, it is subsequently entered into the charting system as a text, but it is entered in as a phone note to make a record of that. I've also contacted the IT department at the hospital and asked them to come up with a way that if a picture message is sent, that can be included in chart. I do feel like that would be more accurate. In speaking a little further on this, because of that, we have something that I would refer to as kind of a triage. I do a large number of surgeries, and when someone comes in, I've trained the staff to ask multiple questions relating to systemic infections or other concerns, one of which is elevating their weight. The combination of that is a triage where it escalates. And if there is concerns, the staff is trained to move forward. No patient at any time is told not to come in. We always provide, even on a busy day when there's nothing else, we routinely work through lunch, stay late, and come in early to accommodate patients, especially when we've entered into a surgical agreement. In this case, information that I was presented never escalated with fevers, chills, redness, drainage, or the like that would elevate it to the point of beyond that triage, that initial triage. In addition, the staff is asked to review what the standard has been, and help them understand how to proceed with the healing at where they're at. And that was also repeated with TA.
So I know you discussed the, we heard of the issues with the billing at the hospital and stuff. And I realize you have no control over how, you know, their systems work and if they're switching and how things are lost. But I just still think it's a good reminder that you are the captain of the ship, and it's, you know, responsibility of the doctor to properly code and give them codes. Pardon, there's backlash there on the phone there, Heather.
Hey, for the participants on the phone, if you could please mute your phone until it's time for you to speak, it would really be much appreciated. We're getting a lot of feedback in the boardroom.
So, you know, that making sure that the billing is done properly. I know when you're an employee of a hospital, that may be not the first thing on your mind, but you're still the one that an insurance company would come back on. So it's your responsibility. Now, with the procedures that you did, was there any possibility or did, with or thought of staging procedures to see how the patient responded instead of having such a large amount of procedures?
So in this case, a fair amount of my practice is reconstructive surgery. Mm-hmm. My approach to it is sometimes staged. I usually will consent for multiple procedures with the word possibility in the consent, depending on what happens. I typically will start with what I feel is the apex of the issue. In this case, with TA, the apex of the issue I felt was two things. There was a hypermobile first metatarsal cuneiform joint that was overloading the lateral column with kind of a flexible 4-foot supinatus. The issue was there was an inability to compensate for that because of the fused hind foot and the prior traumas. So we started with balancing, fusing the first metatarsal phalangeal joint, and then balancing the hind foot into a slight valgus. At that point, the Cotton procedure seemed inappropriate because the deformity shifted to be more distal, and so it was elected to include a plantar flexory osteotomy of the first metatarsal in an attempt to maintain an anatomic or appropriate weight-bearing tripod. The decision was made to proceed with all of these procedures so that, number one, we did not have to re-incise this patient, and also in an attempt to minimize pain after surgery, but it seemed appropriate based on time and the specific procedures to proceed with all of these procedures at the same time as opposed to
Dr. Foreman.
When you went on vacation, did you have a covering physician?
Yes, Dr. Allred, an orthopedic surgeon, was covering for me. I spoke with both him and the emergency department.
And what was your thought on not giving patient TA an antibiotic to go home with?
Following surgery?
Following surgery, yeah.
My thought was, I deal with a number of high-risk patients, and it is based on what I'm reading in the literature, if I appropriately follow sterile protocol, as well as, in this case, the 23 hours of IV antibiotics, I am seeing higher incidence of resistant bacteria with postoperative antibiotics. It was prophylactic, and I was also concerned about multiple issues of C. diff that TA had experienced.
Thank you. Dr. Ilano?
Yes, Dr. Hollow, I've got a question. Postoperatively, what is your protocol to see patients? Meaning, do you see them 2 weeks postoperatively, then 1 month postoperatively, or what is the protocol for you to see the patients postop?
My post-op protocol is to have the patients come in 1 week post-op. If there are sutures that need to be removed, I'm a little bit conservative on how soon I take those out. And there's often a secondary visit for suture removal, depending on the situation, the surgery, and the patient. And then as a standard, approximately 1 month post-operative without other complications, we'll see patients. So it would be 1 week post-op and 1 month as a standard for those first two initial visits.
Okay, and you would see them, not the staff?
On those visits, I see the patient.
Okay. Just, that's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Rose? Well, I live in a rural community, too. And generally, when you have surgery, the primary care physician sends you in for a full workup and a heart stress test and everything. And you know, I don't see that here. And something else, you know, in a rural setting, we do text back and forth to everybody. It's a new form of communication, but also you should follow up with the patient and actually physically see them afterwards. Not just rely on the text. That's pretty much all I'm going to say.
Dr. Hall, you mentioned that on your new system, having some way to have texts come in. Do you get an alert that something has come in, or is it just going to sit there in that chart and you may not see it for a while?
Maybe I can clarify that. We don't have a way for text messages to go into the EMR. We have when a text message comes in, or when there's communication with the patient between visits, it is recorded as a phone visit. It is manually recorded. It does not automatically go in as a text message.
I can clarify a little bit also. So what happens is you'll take a picture of the text on your phone and then upload it into the documents of the patient's chart. Because I mean, even though I'm not in a rural setting, we do it also because the patient doesn't always have to come in or if they have other questions regarding their care.
So let me ask you, what I'd like to know from both you and Dr. Ilano too, what's your confidence level then on, well, telemedicine is kind of what this falls into, and, you know, and using pictures on phones to, as far as your confidence levels, how does, if, as far as your level of expectation and how much you're really able to evaluate a patient?
Well, I usually, if the patient's concerned, I have them come in. You know, if it's over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, I usually Monday, have gone and met patients in my office over the weekend. You know, based upon the picture, how red it is, I always like to visualize a patient also.
Dr. Ilano?
In my practice, I utilize texting and pictures quite a bit. But what I use it for is to accentuate the positive. If everything is good, they send me a picture, I tell them, yeah, good, you don't need to come in. If I do have an occasion where there's a problem, I haven't come into the office. Even if there's a question on the patient's mind, I haven't come in right away. Most of the time, it's just for reassurance. But to me, if there's a problem, I want to see it right away. So in short, I use the text messages and stuff for the positives. For the negatives, I haven't come in right away.
Am I allowed to make a comment? What we do in our office mirrors that. The information that I got, there was never any fevers, there was never any chills, there was never any drainage, there was never anything active. I did use it as a triage tool, but the information from the medical assistants and that I was receiving was that there was never that. It is an absolute standard. If there is a concern, we have them come in. We've had people come in with dirt on their foot, and that's fine, as considering it in some cases being green. Never critical of that. We want them to come in, but I was never given the information this patient is asking to come in, and I was never given the information that there was something that was outside of a normal postoperative recovery, other than struggling with using compression, and as listed in the notes, with the pre-op workup, we did order labs and an EKG. There's a range. If I have a 17-year-old athletic male with no history of issues, with no nothing, I don't routinely get a secondary medical evaluation or clearance. There's obviously a spectrum. In this, it did not, in my mind, elevate to needing medical clearance.
So what ASA level would you have classified her for?
I would have probably classified her, she'd probably have met a lower three.
Yeah, because that was another question, was do you classify the patient, or does the anesthesiologist classify the patient?
Excuse me, sorry. Anesthesia does. And anesthesia reviews all of my charts before I take them to surgery. It is routine that we have something postponed or otherwise. And I am in constant contact with the Department of Surgery chair, who's an anesthesiologist, on this as well. It is a continual refining process, but that is a very established protocol.
My big curiosity was what the protocol and that other eyes are looking to, you know, down in. Of course, again, coming that you're in a smaller community versus, you know, down here, I mean, we used to, it always was the anesthesiologist would do your pre-ops on your outpatient surgeries. And that all changed, and it had to come from the primary care. So I know it's as per hospital, and as long as your insurance company's fine with that procedure and protocol, you know, but that's why we discuss, because every situation is different. So, board members, our job here, always remember, is to ascertain if there have been any possible violations of state statute. And if so, what does this rise to a level of a discipline or a non-disciplinary action? And, you know, we come into these meetings with ideas of what we think happened. Of course, then we listen to everyone, and that gives us better knowledge of making good decisions and so, but I will, again, my concerns that we have here are medical records. I mean, you know, things that were, you know, Dr. Hall admitted that he didn't enter the encounter where the patient was not given any care. It was basically, I believe, a visit to discuss with the patient's significant other partner that what was going on, so, you know, that because she would be in care of her partner, that she would want to know what was going on. But still, that's something, if it's happened, it must be documented, because you get yourself in a situation where there's going to be other people asking questions, they're going to want to know why. Also about the documentation, the op report about doing a procedure that wasn't actually done, and the issue of not appropriately changing a CPT code is also on the doctor's onus. I'm going to move on to, was there anything that was done that could be harmful and dangerous to the health of the patient? And I go back on to conservative care, the issues with, you know, relying on text messages and photos. I've stated my opinion that I'm not very comfortable with those as something to totally hang one's hat on, particularly when you have somebody that had multiple problems. And I think maybe it may have been because the patient was expressing concern that getting them in there and having maybe a higher index of suspicion, you know, maybe not, you know, if this would have prevented the outcome that finally happened. You know, when you're using inappropriate coding, that can be seen, too, as a misrepresentation of what was done. So that can be, you know, some kind of a improper billing, charging for things that you didn't do, but it's like you did. And, again, I go back to one final point on examination, that yes, even though your surgery was based on one limb, I still think thorough and proper documentation and physical examination on a patient, particularly one where you're contemplating surgery, is important. That's, you know, how I see things. I'd like to hear from my board members. And again, remember, our decision is, you know, was there some, were, are these possible violations? And if so, then, you know, we'd have to opt to move to an informal hearing or an informal interview. I'm sorry for more discussion. Or if we feel this did not rise to that level, then is this a non-disciplinary adjudication? So, opinions, please.
I don't see any detriment below the standard of care for this. My concerns is that I would probably teach your staff, if the patient has those concerns, to just come in, even if they're not showing any signs or symptoms of infection, just to assuage the patient also, and what Dr. Campbell said.
Dr. Ilano?
Yeah, it's noted what Dr. Campbell said in regard to charting. I don't feel that this rises below the standard of care. I think it was treated appropriately by Dr. Hall, the patient here.
So then I would propose, let me grab my other stuff here, just a second. Gotta get. So some discussion then on maybe or order for continuing education regarding documentation. What's your thoughts, gentlemen?
Good idea.
Okay, and in any certain amount of CEs above, of course, now these are above normal 25 for licensure. I would issue an order for continuing education. We need to decide. Of course, those are board approved cases or board approved courses. And I would also, in addition, like a letter of concern regarding the stricter monitoring of text messaging and photos as part of patients.
Thing too, this was during the height of COVID, where there was people not wanting to associate or be around other people. So
I understand
that's
that
a
too.
Consideration.
I understand. This is a multifactorial situation. Nothing is ever just one. I don't believe. So, does anyone have any thoughts on amount of education, credits in documentation and charting? Do you want to include coding on that? Dr. Ilano, do you have any thoughts?
Sure, I would include the coding, and I would go for six hours of continuing education.
I didn't catch that, Dr. Ilano.
6 hours?
Okay, so we could do that, maybe 3 hours of coding and 3 hours of documentation?
Sure.
How's that with you, Mr. Rose?
I think that's good. And then timeline for having it done?
It's usually within 6 months of signing of consent or of the order. And then again, in addition to that, the filing of the letter of concern for judicious use of text messaging and photos and relying on. Post-operative, well, for any patient care, for that matter.
It's Dr. Saunders. Can I make a comment?
Sure, sir. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not disagreeing with the CME. I just wanted to reiterate that though the text messaging, I'm not really for it. I do it in my practice as well. I'm going to say that the pictures were not ominous, and in Dr. Hall's defense, it did not seem like there was a significant complication. Going out there. So, you know, if he is using that as part of a medical record and part of the care, I think the documentation needs to be better, where he can document, looked at the picture, and it, you know, looks okay. obviously that's no, you know, the patient can't make it in because of COVID, or patient just couldn't get there. But I am not certain as to how much of the pictures Dr. Hall actually saw. I'm going to say that I looked at some that were provided to the board, and they did not look ominous.
Part of the discussion and just an awareness of that. So it may be on our documentation, as part of that documentation, in regards
into that 3 hours, it involves, you know, these alternative forms of
contact with
and with cell phone usage, and not remove a letter of concern and just follow those instances.
You could do 2 hours for a total of 6 2 hours of each one.
Okay, if does that sound agreeable to
telemedicine? I don't think you're going to find any CME.
There's a lot out there. Oh well, that includes it. Yes, yeah, I have colleagues in California that, yeah, that's a big thing. Yeah, because if they're using that phone to do FaceTime and everything with their patients. So to me, that's part of that use.
Okay, that's telemedicine. Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's kind of lumped together.
I thought you meant text messaging.
Oh, no. Put it together. So using, you know,
telemedicine. Yeah, I think most telemedicines would cover it now.
Pardon me?
Most telemedicine would cover it now, classes especially.
Yeah, yeah.
Considering that we're now a telehealth board.
Right, yeah. So we could split it, yeah, have the 2 hours of telemedicine, and then we've got 2 hours of documentation, 2 hours of coding.
Second.
Okay, thank you for that. So we have moved and seconded. Any other discussion on this action? Okay, we'll go ahead and take a voice vote. All in favor, Dr. Ilano?
Aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. Moved, seconded, and passed. Heather will be in contact with you, Dr. Hall, and also if the complainant has any concerns, she may also contact Heather. Heather will give her let her know how the process now proceeds. So,
did you have a question?
Thank you very much. Yeah, do you have any questions?
This may already be in part of it. Is it possible to get a list of where those appropriate courses are? I have obviously no concern doing that.
Heather, do you have to? You can reach out to Heather. Okay. If you have any, if you can find any too, you can reach out to Heather and provide those to her.
Present Podiatry Online will have everything.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, look at they have
everything.
They have very good coursework on there. Yeah. Yes, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. I just need a little five-minute break. Heather, I'm going to call for a five-minute recess. Thank you. I just need to.
Hi, this is Heather Broaddus. Is Mr. Hall and Dr. Yudupa still on the call?
Yeah, this is Mr. Hall. I'm still on the phone. Thank you.
Oh, and Dr. Saunders? Okay, and Dr. Saunders?
Yes, I'm here still.
Okay, we're going to take a five-minute recess, so if you guys just want to hang on the phone for about 5 minutes, okay? Thank you.
I'm going to go myself. Yes,
yep,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I'm muted.
Air. Dr. Saunders?
I'm here.
I'm sorry, I didn't have my mic on. Bad me.
Yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and have you give your investigating report for Dr. Yudupa's case 21-05-3. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Now this one seems like it's a little bit more for the legal team than for me, but I did go through it. There, So apparently there was a complaint against one of the vascular surgeons as part of this group, Modern Vascular. And upon doing the Arizona Medical Board doing their due diligence, they discovered this entity and referred a complaint regarding our doctor. I don't know where it kind of came from. It seems like it was, an inconsequential thing, and not regarding the care, just something that Dr. Upta had come across. I don't know if there's any agenda by the board, bias, but they were doing their due diligence and revealed this matter. And basically, the problem is that doctor referred to an entity for which he had a financial interest without disclosing it to the patient. So there's a written response. Mr. Hall, I believe, does a pretty good interpretation of the question. Stark Law, this is a little bit out of my scope. I printed off the DHS, Designated Health Services, and tried to read through that regarding the Stark Law, and, I didn't go to that class. So the main concern was that Dr. Upta was not revealing to his patients that he was in a relationship with Modern Vascular on his own account. Now he does do this, written and verbally, I believe. Going through the chart, if it's of any concern here, doctor has seen the patient a few times for some ingrown toenails. Subsequently, uneventful. After doing a procedure at one point, the patient dropped something on the great toe and follow up for care. Doctor basically diagnosed it as a contusion, and in follow-up noted that the circulation had had some changes. It was previously normal. Now it looks like it was more faint. And in the patient's best interest, the doctor referred him to Modern Vascular for an evaluation. And doing some wound care at that point. And that's where it basically stops. I believe the patient went on to heal inconsequently at that point. As far as the foot is concerned, some vascular procedures I have 2,000 pages of the complaint against the vascular surgeons. That's neither here nor there for us to go through. I reviewed the billing of CORE and the doctor's charts, and inconsequently, I had found that patient was already a patient of CORE's tax ID number, and we billed a new patient code initially, but that was back in 2016. When I reviewed the chart, discussed via some emails and such with the doctor, I believe all medical care at this point meets expectations. Patient had a problem. The doctor was astute enough, found it, and referred out for vascular. I don't have a problem with that. As far as the initial concern, I'm going to have to turf that to the legal team. I don't think it makes a difference as to what the concern is whether or not the doctor refers, whether or not the doctor acknowledges to the patient that he belongs or not to this group, whether or not that makes a difference. Doctor did refer to Modern Vascular. There is some loose association there as far as the doctor at Modern Vascular's group. I don't necessarily think that this is a Stark violation. And Medicare itself, it wasn't even an issue. The patient had private insurance. If that gets into the fray or not. In communication, I think in Dr. Upta's response, he does make note that it's worth mentioning that Modern Vascular is not the only vascular organization that he refers to. Pending the situation, he refers to other groups as well. I think that's perhaps of note. And outside that, I don't see any breach in standard of care that was done at this point.
No, I agree with you. This patient had a lot of problems, and obviously Dr. Udupa was doing his due diligence and getting this patient proper evaluation and care. And again, like you said, the explanation from Cody Paul
as to the relationship that the doctor has with the entity. And obviously, too, there was no evidence of fee splitting, so there's nothing unprofessional that happened here. So, well, Dr. Yadupa and Mr. Hall, if you'd like to make remarks, you are so kindly present, please.
Thank you, Madam President. This is Cody Hall. I will just make a brief statement and follow up to Dr. Saunders' comments, which is the issue here does appear to have arisen from the medical board's investigation and their concern that there may have been a violation of the Board of Podiatry statute. And again, as near as I could tell, the only issue that was really under investigation is whether the referral to Modern Vascular of Sun City violated any Board of Podiatry statute. It sounds like the members of the board and Dr. Saunders have obviously reviewed the letter that I prepared, and the referral to Modern Vascular of Sun City certainly does not run afoul of a referral that's prohibited by the Stark Act. The services for which the patient was referred to Modern Vascular of Sun City is not one of the 10 designated health services for which a physician is not allowed to make a referral if they have a financial financial investment in the referral entity. So I would just renew my request that the board dismiss the complaint, and I will certainly answer any questions that anybody may have as well. And Dr. Yadupa is also certainly willing to answer any questions that the board members may have.
I don't believe any board members have expressed any comments or questions they'd like to address. So, Dr.
I'll make
Foreman.
A motion to dismiss case number 21-05-C.
Do I have a second?
Second the motion.
Thank you.
Second the motion.
Any discussion? All right. All in favor, signify aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yes. So let's move on to B, which is the issuance of licenses. We have five applications here. Our first is Daphne Davis. She will be briefing her program on the 30th of June. All the application is complete. Did anybody have any questions or concerns with that application? Hearing none, I will move to accept the doctor's application for licensure and issuing the license upon completion of the residency and payment of the license issuance fee.
Seconded.
Discussion? All in favor, signify aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Next is Dr. Eric Chin, also in residency, with a completion date of 6/30/21. Director says that the doctor is in good standing and says it completed all rotations and met surgery and diversity numbers required by CPME. So they're saying that all the requirements have been met on this doctor. So any questions or concerns? So the application is complete and residency requirements are met. So I'll move to accept the application for licensure and issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Seconded.
Discussion? All in favor, signify aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved.
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Third is Dr. Brian Haven. He is on track to graduate on the 30th of June also. The letter says he's in good standing. So I will, anybody have any questions on this application? All right. So everything is completed here. So I will make a motion to accept the application for licensure and to issue the license upon completion of the residency and payment of the issuance fee.
Seconded.
All in favor, or discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved.
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Tyler Reber, he is, completed, his residency was completed on 3/31/21. But he graduates on the 26th, so it's like all his requirements were completed on the 31st, and but he graduates on the 26th of June, has a Washington State license. So any questions on Dr. Reber's application? So everything has been complete and statute met. Make a motion to accept the application for licensure and issue the license on payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Aye.
Thank you. So moved. And our last one is Christopher Van Damme. He is finishing a residency at the Maricopa County residency on the 30th of he did indicate a consent agreement while he was working as a paramedic. He had not completed on the application. He didn't answer about the consent agreement, but that was rectified by addressing this with the licensee application, that he did not do that nefariously. It was he figured I was on the NB, and you know, on the National Practitioner Data Bank. So, but that was corrected. So, anybody have any questions or concerns there? All right. If hearing none, I will make a motion accept the application for licensure upon completion of the residency and payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor signify with aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So
aye.
Thank you, Dr. Lano. All right, so we'll move on to C, which is Dr. Farrell's compliance update. And at this time, he has indicated to Heather that he has not performed any nerve decompression cases, so this. We'll move on to six, which is our review and discussion on personnel matters regarding appointment and compensation for an interim executive director for Margaret Whelan. So, Heather, if you want to.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. As you're aware, my last day with the board is June 25th, and we will be scheduling a meeting to review potential applicants and resumes for my position, but in the meantime, we will need an interim executive director. And Margaret Whelan has offered to take up that position, and she has done interim work for this board in the past. So I did send a contract over. The board does need to approve that contract if it's, you know, if it accepts Ms. Whelan as the interim executive director. And if you have any questions regarding the contract, I can answer those questions.
Anybody have any questions for Heather?
How is she paid?
It would be similar to how our board investigators are compensated. It's a contract work. Mm-hmm.
In order to accept that, do we have to have the value on there for hourly rate? What did Louis Cristomondi did he have?
It's standard that interim executive director would get paid their hourly rate.
And okay, that's okay. I just so we don't have to. Then if anybody has any questions, has reviewed that. Accept the contract between this board and Margaret Director.
Seconded.
Any discussion? Do we have to do a roll call vote? Dr. Yolano.
Aye.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Foreman.
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell.
Aye.
Yes, who was it? Dr. Foreman. All right, now let's thank you. Let's move on to seven. Review, discussion, action on upcoming statutory changes to the board statutes in regards to SB 1284.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. The legislative session still has not ended, that the legislature is not adjourned. So the SB 1284 still will not become effective until 90 days after the legislative session. But after speaking with Dr. Campbell a little bit, we thought it was a good idea to put this on the agenda just so the board is aware of some of the changes that will need to be made regarding the application, the fees, and the other two issues are the residency requirement is changing to a 36-month residency. So it may be a good idea to let some of the residency program directors know that this change is coming. That would be up to the board to determine. And also in September of 2022, it will be required that a fingerprint clearance card be submitted with the initial application and renewal application. So that will need to be a change too to the renewal form and the application form. So some of these changes will have to be made through asset because of the e-license application and the fees, but the PDF copies, I can work on those and bring those back to the board in the future for approval. And those are the changes that I see that will need to be made. The podiatric medical assistant definition is also going to become effective, so the board will have to go through the rulemaking process again to clarify a program and whether or not, you know, they can take x-rays, just those sorts of issues for the podiatric medical assistants. But two, if the board is going to be going through the rulemaking process, it may want to consider creating fees in rules for a duplicate wall card, duplicate wall certificate, because the board will have authority to create those fees now in statute. So that's what I see. I don't know if any of the board members see any other sections that are being changed that we will have to take action on any forms or fees.
We don't need to on records retention.
No. We will not have to take any action on any forms or anything like that for that section.
Any other questions, guys?
With the residencies now, you can still be, say you have a 1 year and you're transferring from New York, you can still be, you don't need a 3 year for everybody if you're going in
by
comedy.
No, you do. That's a requirement.
But if you're applying by comedy.
It's, yeah, if you, like, if somebody like me, right. that's what was available, you go back to what was the statute at that time when that person graduated. So, yes, that's, yeah.
It would only apply to those applicants who are not licensed in another jurisdiction. They may hold a temporary, like, resident license, but
right.
They're not independently licensed. Do we need a motion for sending a letter to program directors or anything?
I would make a motion then to direct Heather to send letters to residency directors in Arizona regarding the statutory change of residencies to being 36 months.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Dr. Yolano.
Aye. I said aye. I'm turning it on and off.
Don't be napping now.
Okay. I'm not napping. I'm with you.
Okay. Just teasing. Okay. So it's been moved, seconded, and passed. All right. So we'll move on. If that contains everything there, to Heather's executive director report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. I already discussed the legislature still in session. The only other update I have is regarding renewals. To date, I've processed 166 renewals, and only the one licensee has indicated that he will be retiring. I can answer any questions on the budget, and I did also submit the complaint log. The board members that are present do have the current complaint log in their folders, and there's only been one new complaint added since I sent out board materials. And I can answer any questions on that complaint log as well. And that concludes my summary.
So, Heather, what is on next month's schedule, ma'am?
We have two initial complaints to be reviewed and one informal.
Excuse me, my damn allergies. Oh, that would be case 21-06-C. And what are the ones that are the initials?
I don't believe that we can discuss.
We can't say those numbers, but could it was okay for me to say the other one or not? Probably not. Okay. Okay.
And I should also mention, too, that I have received some resumes for my position, so I will be contacting board members to set up a meeting to a public meeting to go over those resumes.
So any summary of current events? And we have a call to the public, but no. Yes, sir. Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you for reminding me. So we can go back to that. There's no public to call. I was expecting that the audience was going to remain and maybe they had a call. But so, yes, let's go back to four for our minutes. General session minutes of May 12th, 2021. Anybody have any concerns with those minutes? Okay, I didn't see any. So I will make a motion to accept the general session minutes from 5/12/21 as written. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you. Then Heather put in our supplement. We have the minutes from the telephonic meeting of 5/28/21. Not see any issues or have any additions or corrections. Does anyone else? Hearing none, I will move to accept our telephonic meeting minutes from 5/28/21.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. So back to 11. Anybody have any items they'd like to see on future agenda, future meeting minute or agenda?
Just the radiology.
Yeah, and that, you know, that will continue with discussion as far as, you know, with that we had that initial discussion not last month, but the month before with the Arizona State Association. So basically that will happen then when we start with rules. We need to do that education. So what we have to then, at once that's kind of, I think, set in stone with, that's what the association is going to go for education to assistance, that then we have to apply for an exemption with.
That's correct, Madam Chair, board members. So it's still going to be a process because the board does have to create rules regarding, Dr. Campbell said, the educational requirements for podiatric medical assistance and address x-rays. Once the Department of Health Services sees that the board has those in rules, then we can request the exemption from the requirement that they take the national.
Do we have to wait the 90 days after it passes? So, okay. So,
but, right, because that technically is not effective. That definition is not effective, yeah.
Have to keep it on our radar.
Unfortunately, everything is...
It's on radar, yeah. And our next meeting is July the 14th, 2021. So, seeing we have no other... If anybody has any other business...
Ask how is the applications for executive director going? It's been posted and everything.
It's not agendized for today.
And I did just summarize that in my executive director's report that I am receiving those, so I will be sending a board, you know, I will be talking with board members to set up a meeting at some point to go through those resumes. Yes. That was in my executive director's report.
Yeah. Okay. So then we've concluded business. Nobody has anything else. I will make motion to adjourn the meeting at 10:53 a.m. on June 9th, 2021.
Second it.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So, aye.
Thank you, Dr. Ulano.
You're welcome, everybody. Have a great day, everyone.
You too.